All right, everyone, welcome back.
Is this okay?
So, let's talk about some of these tribal court cases that are under Point 14. No, I'm teaching my class. I live in a house full of people who keep interrupting me. Plus a dog who's not a people. All right. So let's talk about FMC versus Rincon Band just a little bit. Not involved in this case, unlike the other two. But this one is pending at the Supreme Court right now. And in fact, today, the court is in conference and will decide whether or not to hear this case. Again, this is one of those, so FMC is filing cert petition. Why does it say Rincon Band? It's actually Shoshone Bannock. That's my typo. I'm sorry about that. The Shoshone Bannock tribe is the respondent. And I'm fixing it right now before I forget. The attorney for FMC, which is a big company, is Gregory Gehr, longtime Supreme Court practitioner, has argued probably several dozen cases at this point, is a big name at the Supreme Court, and it's important that it's him because at the Supreme Court, names matter. There's probably a dozen or two, maybe three dozen people that argue all the cases at the Supreme Court, something like 90 to 95% of them. And if you want to win and be taken seriously, you need to hire one of those people. And they bill between $1,500 and $2,000 an hour. So if you can be one of those people, you're in great shape. He's one of those people. The tribe has hired Neil Katyal to defend it at the Supreme Court. So he wrote a nice cert opposition brief that kind of shuts down what Gregor Gehr's position is. I'll get to that in a moment. And I bring this up because it's important when you are at the Supreme Court that it is not a liberal or democratic institution at all. It is very much an old boys network. They still have a spittoon behind the court in case anybody's chewing a tobacco and wants to spit it out. That is a part of the tradition of the court. And, you know, they're a very traditional institution. So this is a big deal. This is a large corporation, kind of like Dollar General was. They're a bad actor. They dumped 22 million tons of toxic and radioactive waste on the reservation that has made the reservation uninhabitable, large chunks of it uninhabitable for the foreseeable future, hundreds if not thousands of years. And they're asking the Supreme Court to excuse them from paying fines to the tribe. So, it's an extremely good chance this case will be granted. And by extremely good, I mean something, you know, probably less than 50%, but close to it, given that the grant rate is about 1% for all petitioners. For it to be that high gives you a sense of how important this case is. Important-ish. The claim basically is this, that FMC has been on the reservation for many decades, off and on. In the early part of the time that they were there, they were just dumping, probably at the invitation or request or acquiescence of the Department of the Interior, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, as a place for them to very cheaply get rid of a bunch of waste they don't know what to do with. It's very much a question of environmental justice. You don't dump stuff like this in Manhattan. You dump stuff like this in Indian country. That is just the pattern and practice of, you know, for however long we've had toxic and radioactive waste. The tribe has previously litigated a Montana II type case before, not against FMC, but against an individual, much like the Brendale case, post-Strait. So it was after Brendale, but after Strait as well. And the individual was somebody who was putting up a house, and the tribe wanted to exercise regulatory jurisdiction over them, and the Ninth Circuit said this does not implicate Montana II at all. It's just a house. And by the way, tribe, did you notice that your entire reservation is a toxic and radioactive wasteland? How could one more house make it that much worse? By the way, I have to point that out because it comes relevant in the Rincon ban case. So poor Shoshone Bannock has lost Montana two cases in the past that they probably would have lost anyway, but the court has to grind them into the dust and say, and by the way, your reservation is a shithole to begin with. So how could it possibly be any worse if some white guy puts up a house? That's the kind of way these cases are adjudicated and decided. But now we have a claim by the tribe against the very entity that made their reservation a toxic and radioactive hellhole. What has happened since FMC has dumped all of the 22 million tons is that the EPA came in and forced them under various federal statutes to do some cleanup work. And you got the CERCLA, which is, I don't know the acronym for, but those of you who take in environmental law know a little bit about CERCLA, the Superfund statute, and some other federal statutes at play that have forced the FMC Corp to do some cleanup and to pay the tribe some licensing royalty issues. The FMC reached a consent judgment, a consent agreement with the EPA, in which it agreed to pay the tribe $1 million a year, basically in perpetuity, so long as there is toxic waste on the reservation. They did that for a couple of years, and then they stopped several years ago now. And the tribe brought a claim against them saying, we have this statute that says you owe us $1 million a year. We have a consent judgment. You have a consent judgment with EPA that says you owe us $1 million a year. Pay us $1 million a year, going back several years now, because it's a lot of years that they haven't paid. And FMC just says, no, we don't got to, because we're non-Indians and non-members in your tribe, and you can't make us do it. Maybe EPA could make us do it, but they're not making us do it, so we're not going to do it. You know, it's like a neener, neener, neener thing. We'll do what we want. In any event, the tribe litigated against FMC for many years in tribal court. FMC's biggest argument at this point is that two of the tribal appellate judges were invited to speak at some sort of bar function, not liquor bar, but more of a state lawyer bar function, to talk about tribal courts in general. And a couple of them supposedly spouted off about FMC and how they were behaving. And so FMC is saying that at the appellate court level, anyway, the tribal judges were biased against FMC. Now, what they said, even the way FMC characterized the way they said, you can read it in the briefs, really isn't all that unusual. Federal judges talk this about stuff like this all the time, and don't get too much trouble for it. So it shouldn't be unusual, but it's a point that doesn't look good in the context of how the Supreme Court already views tribal judges. Tribal judges demographically and statistically speaking are way different than federal and state judges, in that many of them tend to be Indian people themselves. They tend to also be people that are, you don't get a lot of conservative business-oriented or criminal prosecution-oriented judges on tribal courts. There are some, sure, but not really in the same vein as what is on the Supreme Court itself. Even Justice Sotomayor got her experience as a prosecutor. My sense is that she wouldn't be on the Supreme Court if she was a public defender back in, her early years. I could be wrong on that. They look very much askance at tribal judges to begin with. And the FMC in their petition is telling the Supreme Court that this is a ridiculous abuse of process. And I will point out that's exactly what Dollar General did when they attacked Frank Palmersheim. That's what Plains Commerce Bank did when they attacked Frank Palmersheim again. That's what the non-members always do, is to impugn the integrity of the court and the judges themselves. It's actually happened to me, and I'll talk about that in the Lake of the Torches case in a moment. So I don't know if they're going to grant this case. You know, the EPA is not a party to the tribal court proceeding, but they are the reason that there's $1 million per year judgment obligation of FMC to pay to the tribe. And we know about the EPA right now. I've mentioned them just in this class this week. They are Trump's EPA. And I can, and the Solicitor General, I can see the Solicitor General saying, take this case. And by the way, we're not going to enforce the consent judgment because we don't think that it's properly applied as the EPA, as the United States, and which is not a particularly strong position to take at the Supreme Court. They like the government to be consistent and to behave properly towards parties. But they usually excuse the United States when they do behave like shitheads. So I really don't know what's going to happen here. I strongly suspect that in the next couple of weeks, maybe not from this conference that happened today, we'll get orders from that conference either tomorrow or Monday. It might be a few weeks from now, but I strongly suspect the court will ask for the views of the Solicitor General. And it's Trump's Solicitor General, so who knows what they're going to say. If they were behaving ethically and following the law, they would say that EPA, they said they were going to pay the tribe $1 million a year, and EPA is going to hold them to that word, or maybe they're not. We don't know. And it's not even entirely clear what the Supreme Court cares what the SG will say. But this case is absolutely ripe for a CVSG, unless for some reason the court thinks that's so ridiculous and just denies cert in the first place. I don't think that's going to be the case, but it'll be a long time, I think, before we actually know what's going to happen in FMC, whether it's going to go to the Supreme Court. Any questions on that one? Okay, Rincon Band versus Donius, also known as Rincon versus Rincon Mushroom Company. So Donius is the owner of a company called Rincon Mushroom, and they grow mushrooms. I'm not making that up. That's what they do. They grow mushrooms and they sell them mail order to people around the country who are really into cooking with mushrooms. And I use the word cooking as broadly as possible. The tribe thinks that this guy is just straight up a drug dealer and distributes hallucinogenics to people around the country and does so on non-Indian-owned land within the Rincon Band Reservation, but they can't prove it. So let's talk a little bit about this case. The Rincon Band Reservation is in San Diego County. Google it sometime. It's really useful to see the image of the reservation from space using Google Space or whatever. It's a small reservation. It's probably less than a full square mile. You can see the tribe's casino is a massive complex. I've stayed there. It's very nice, very huge. There's a two-lane blacktop highway that kind of curves through the reservation. The casino's on one side, along with the parking lot. The casino parking lot, which is vast. And on the other side of the parking lot is the road. And then on the other side of that is an area that looks like a kind of like a dump. It's within a fencing area. There's some trucks there. There's a couple of buildings that, you know, one kind of looks like a garage. There's usually some sheds out there. Sometimes there are trailer trucks that are just parked there. It's just dirt, hardscrabble dirt. This is the desert. Since the late aughties, the tribe has really wanted to regulate and or get rid of this property. They've tried to buy it. The people won't. The Donius won't sell it. They've tried to figure out. The tribe has tried to inspect the property over the years and is not allowed access to certain parts of the property. They can see through the chain link fence that it's kind of an eyesore. There have been multiple incidents over the years that have bordered on disaster. One of those incidents was a few years back, and there was a big fire in San Diego County that raced toward the tribal casino and the mushroom company's property. It actually touched and reached parts of the company's lands, and whoever was, you know, maintaining the company's area actually left out a bunch of, you know, oil gas drums and shit like that just lying around. And it exploded and started a big fire. And because the winds were huge, the tribe maintains that, and they showed us a video, which is not really well done because it's probably an older iPhone or something. But there were cinders that were flying from this explosion, carried by the winds over into the parking lot, and actually landed on the roof of the casino, which is something like 15 or 20 stories high. It's huge. And the argument that the tribe is making is that with that experience, that the stuff that's on this property is hazardous, is a fire hazard in an area that is subjected to forest fire, or, you know, grass fires and ugly, you know, fires that go out of control. Stuff actually has exploded on that territory and on that land and landed on the tribe's casino. The tribe's argument is this meets the Montana 2 test, because if they lose the casino, the tribe is done. They have no other source of revenue. Not really. I mean, they probably have 638 contracts that it's a small tribe with small land base. So I'm sure the 638 contracts are pretty close to nothing. The casino, on the other hand, is the source of all of their revenue for all practical purposes. And if that goes away, then the tribe, you know, is kind of doomed. So what has never really been litigated is whether or not the loss of a tribe's, you know, economic development revenue by the action of non-members is enough to implicate Montana too. We don't know. We know a busload of Indians being killed by a railroad is not. So I shouldn't say busload, truckload, carload. I don't know. So it's not entirely clear if that is going to pass muster under Montana too. But that's one of the arguments. The other is that the tribe's the water table that the tribe relies upon, the water source, includes the lands upon which the mushroom company is located. And there have been, especially after the fire, but even before that, there have been leaks from things that have been dumped on that property that have gone into the water table. And luckily for the tribe, it has seeped into the water table. And, you know, like how water tables are, the water moves. And it has moved, but in a direction away from the tribe. The tribe argues, but still on the reservation, the tribe argues that it has a well that is on the other side of the mushroom company's territory that it relies upon that could be contaminated by leakages from the mushroom company. And if that's the case, that's their sole source of water. You could have, again, that's an alternate theory as to why Montana 2 would be implicated. The tribe is really frustrated by the mushroom company. The mushroom company refuses to acknowledge whatsoever any tribal authority, will not allow the tribe or its inspectors, planners, anybody to go onto the property and inspect and see what's going on. San Diego County has an agreement with Rincon Band and some of the other tribes in San Diego County that they will not regulate on-reservation activities. So San Diego County will not go in and inspect mushroom territory or the mushroom company or anything like that. There's a fence. They could. I mean, they'd have to break down the fence. I should add, though, that in the last couple of years, the tribe has gone on and inspected several times, usually at the requirement of a tribal court order. And actually the most recent tribal court order, the one on appeal for the case that you had read, the tribal court issued an order saying that the mushroom company had to let the tribe on to inspect. And they did, but they wouldn't let them into certain places, like the building. The big building that's there, they can only look in through the dirty garage door windows. So they can't actually see what's in there. So it's a frustrating thing, because on one hand, if the mushroom company really wasn't doing anything bad, then letting somebody in to inspect the property would reveal that there's no impact. But if they are doing something bad, and the tribe firmly believes that they are, they can't get in to prove it. And every time they do go on, and it's been a few times now, to inspect the property, they haven't found anything that's all that terrible. So it's just one of those things. It's just a ridiculous pissing match between the tribe and its attorneys and Denias Mushroom Company and its attorneys. And this has been going on for more than most of a decade now. And I'm not really sure. It seems to me that it is just ripe for having some sort of settlement, just a one and done kind of thing. But this mushroom company, they're just like the strongest form of libertarian you can get. They're in a place where they know that they don't, San Diego County will not touch them. The EPA has gone in at the time when there was that explosion and did do some cleanup. But, you know, the EPA does not go on small parcels of land and inspect all the time. That's really a local government function. And the tribe can't do it because of the Montana test. Or at least in theory. I mean, they're litigating that right now, so that's an ongoing question. But basically what you have is this Denias guy is in this weird legal limbo where nobody can inspect his property. And he's really enjoying it a great deal. I mean, it is palpable when I would listen to the oral argument how it almost seems like the guy's having fun just fucking with the tribe. And in fact, at times, I mean, there's stuff in the transcript where the guy says, hey, you know what? If I wanted to put anything I want on this land up to a nuclear waste dump, I could do that. He's just sort of taunting them. I really don't know. Nobody knows what, if anything, is going on here. I think the tribe, it, just as a personal matter, I'm done with the case. The opinion's out. There might be a remand. I don't know. And it's not that the court has a huge pool of judges to draw from. I'm not sure that I would even get drawn again by this tribe to hear this case again. I really don't know if that's the case. So I might get called back into it again, but I would say it's fair that the tribe, I think they would concede that they want this guy out of here because he's right across from their casino and they want to make their casino property and the environs around it look nice as a resort community, as a resort area. And this is compared to that, is an eyesore. And doesn't really, there's nothing the tribe can do about it. And that's why they're adjudicating this case. So the other aspect of this case that's kind of interesting and creates complexity that, as a judge, I wish I wouldn't have to deal with. As an aside, I mentioned this before, as a tribal judge, I follow tribal law. So if the tribe creates a constitution and a series of codes in which it asserts the right to exercise jurisdiction over all persons within reservation boundaries, regardless of what the Supreme Court says under Montana or whatever, I follow the tribal law. I feel bound to do that. And not all tribal judges are like that, right? They will go directly to Montana. Frank Pomersheim, for example, says Montana is the law of the land. I'm going to comply with Montana, or I'm going to apply Montana as a judge. I don't feel that way because I don't think that's right. Supreme Court precedent is not precedent in tribal court unless the tribe adopts it as tribal law. And many, many tribal constitutions will say something along the lines of the tribe's inherent powers are all of the inherent powers that any sovereign possesses. Unless federal law says to the contrary, then I think you do have to follow the Montana test or whatever test is applicable. In this case, the tribe created a land use ordinance that I've never seen anything like before, where it took the way that the court talked about the Montana test and codified it from the Plains Commerce Bank decision. So this fight with Mushroom Company, I think, extends as far back as to the year or two after Plains Commerce Bank. So that would have been the court's most recent statement of what the Montana exceptions are. And the tribe codified it. They took that snapshot in time and put it into their code. But they changed some things, too, which is weird. And I tried to, in the oral argument, try to tease out why it is the tribe, A, adopted the Plains Commerce Bank version of the Montana test, and B, why they changed things from that version. They included the phrase, for example, the catastrophic impact on Pi's HW. I didn't get an answer. I don't think they even thought it was worth answering my question. And I don't think they knew the answer. I suspect that the attorney who argued for Rincon probably was the guy who advised them to codify the Plains Commerce Bank version of the Montana tests, Montana exceptions, but I don't know that for sure. And again, I don't know why they altered it the way they did. I don't know. It's the whole thing is weird to me. They just don't remember. So we have had to apply the Montana test and its exceptions. But that had been modified from Supreme Court jurisprudence. The two judges on the court with me were retired federal judges. One was a federal district court judge from the Southern District, and the other was a former federal circuit judge. It's kind of rarefied air to be, and for somebody like me, to sit on a panel with those guys. And they're both really old and retired, and you know, they don't know a whole lot about Indian law, so I had to sort of sit through listening to them figure out how to get to where I already was. You know, it's just one of those things. But two really good guys. I never met him. We did all of this online. I was Zooming. That was my first time using Zoom way back in January this year. In any event, we had to figure out a way to apply the Montana test after all, because the tribe codified it. And they created this weird process that if it's a non-member within the reservation boundaries, and the tribe unilaterally decides that the Montana test is met, then it tells the non-member to explain itself, to write some sort of plan as to what it's planning to do with its, how it's going to deal with the tribe's unilateral determination that it is engaging in something that is potentially catastrophic to the tribe. It's a really weird thing. They could have written it to mean to say that if the tribe starts to worry that there is a Montana 2 type thing going on across the street, then to write the letter and see what the response is from the non-member and then adjudicate whether or not it meets the actual Montana 2 test as adopted by the tribe, but they did it all backwards. And so that made everything really complicated. And the attorney for the Mushroom Company really just revels in playing with the tribe, and all of the statutes are really odd, spending a lot of time sort of articulating conspiracy theories about why the tribe adopts certain rules, trying to make a lot of hay about tribal officials or tribal employees who do weird things, like look at them through binoculars. And I mean, a lot of the argument was read a lot like something you would read in social media about, you know, coronavirus conspiracy theories. It just was a surreal thing to watch. But it's not surprising, because that's how non-members adjudicate tribal court jurisdiction cases. It's not all that different than Gregory Gersay. Did you see what the tribal judges were saying at the state bar convention? You know, stuff like that is just pattern and practice of what non-members do in these types of cases. And it's frustrating. And they would never do that, almost never do that in state or federal court with state or federal judges, but it's pretty routine in tribal court cases. So I can see that I was a bit skeptical of the tribe's position that this met the Montana case. This case has been to the Ninth Circuit a couple of times already. On the exhaustion question, the tribe tried to enforce its rule against Mushroom Company years ago, and the company went straight to federal court, tried to get an injunction, failed, appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit ruled against the tribe, saying there's no colorable or plausible jurisdiction here, and excused the Mushroom Company from even having to exhaust tribal remedies. But that was reversed en banc on the definition of what plausible or colorable means. So it is plausible or colorable. I agree with that completely. For purposes of showing that, you know, the Mushroom Company's actions might, if we have the complete discovery and the development of the record might actually implicate Montana too. I don't know. The tribe's allegations are sensational enough that it would seem to at least plausibly be a threat, a catastrophic threat to the tribe. So that's every time the tribal court, and then the case is remanded to the tribal court, they file the cert petition too. Every time the case goes back to tribal court and the court issues another order, even a preliminary order, a status hearing order, Mushroom Company files a motion in federal district court to try to stay and enjoin the proceeding, saying it's totally frivolous, it's totally abusive. And so they're always going back and forth between federal and tribal court. They've actually been to the tribal appellate court once before, years ago. Before the tribe actually constituted its own appellate court, it would use the Southern California Intertribal Appellate Court. It still uses the Southern California Intertribal Court for its trial level judges, but its own appellate court. And for a while, it used the Intertribal Court as well for the appellate court system. But now it hired its own judges, people like me, independent contractors, to constitute a Rincon appellate court. All of this goes to show that there's just an enormous amount of play because of the exhaustion doctrine. You can go back and forth between tribal and federal court over and over again, depending on how litigious the parties are. And these guys are really litigious. So by the time the case gets to us, we still don't have a full record. As I said, the trial judge, who I'm not even sure is a lawyer, wrote an order that said that the tribe met its burden of proof under Montana 2, but did not hold a trial. Basically, it was on the cross motions for summary judgment, and ordered the Mushroom Company to allow the tribe on to inspect the premises. And, you know, like I said, they did go on to inspect the premises, but they didn't learn anything that they didn't already know from looking through the chain link fence. As the sense I got. And so, you know, when the Ninth Circuit earlier said, send this back down for a full development of the record, that has still not occurred. And I don't think Mushroom Company will let it ever happen unless the tribe just breaks into their facility and literally forces an inspection. And I don't think this tribe will do that. And if they do, I guarantee you they will be totally dinged in federal court. So it's a terrible place for the tribe to be. On the other hand, I don't know that there's anything there. Nobody knows. You know, these are people who sell mushrooms. You know, you can order mushrooms online to cook soup with, and that's all this company does. And occasionally let bikers park their bikes there and truck drivers park their trucks there. And on occasion dump some oil drums and leave a mess and make it look ugly. And there's no lawn and it's gross. And it's a big ugly chain link fence with a concertina wire at the top of it. That's, as far as I can tell, according to the record, that's the extent of it. Unless the tribe is right. And inside that building, they have like a drug dealing operation or a, I don't know, some sort of catastrophic environmental and pollution operation, which I, you know, seems unlikely, but it's possible. We just don't know. It's a surreal case. And so, you know, the court, the other two judges were just absolutely adamant. This meets Montana too easily. So I thought I would be the one to have to like, be the pro-tribal guy, and I'm not. I was the one who was more skeptical. I still don't really know for sure. I didn't write the opinion. I did write the parts about tribal jurisdiction, but I said, look, I'm interpreting a tribal code, and to me it's not the same as the Montana test. So that's how I looked at it. All right, that's too much talking. Any other questions? There were never any questions to begin with, because nobody cares about this case. It'll be up in the Ninth Circuit in the next few years, and you'll read about it again, I'm sure. Okay, the very last one I want to talk about is another one I worked on many years ago, and I'll try to make it quick. This is the fact pattern in this case is ridiculous. So there's this tribe in northern Wisconsin. They got no money. Lac du Flambeau Band, Ojibwe. They have a casino, but it generates maybe $15 million a year, not very much. And it's not a huge tribe, so you know, their 638 money is pretty limited. And they're always they in Wisconsin, their gaming facility, they're kind of stuck where they are. Forest County Potawatomi, incidentally, is a tribe that's way up there with them. And very early on, after the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was adopted, they persuaded a governor to let them open a casino in suburban Milwaukee. So Forest County Potawatomi is super rich, but they've been effective at blocking any other tribe from entering the Milwaukee market. So nobody else can get it. And Lac du Flambeau, you know, during the late 90s, early aughties, was seduced into signing an agreement to do, you know, a sort of a casino development proposal for off-reservation gaming in Mississippi on the Gulf Coast. And the deal was is they would fund these venture capitalists who would then take the tribe's money, which was the tribe promised $1 million a month. So almost all of their gaming profits to the casino development people that they would then use IGRA and their political contacts to get a casino open in Mississippi on the Gulf Coast. And if you know anything about Mississippi Gulf Coast, back in the late 90s, early aughties, under state law, gambling was only authorized if you were not on the land of the state. So the casinos on the Gulf Coast literally were built on giant stilts that extended out into the Gulf of Mexico, into the Caribbean. And you could park on the beach and then walk across the ramp that would take you to the casino. That was a lot of states were doing that back in the day. Like in Indiana, you could only be in a casino if you were in a riverboat, not on the land of the state. And I don't really know why that is. It's all these red states that did stuff like that. So anyway, I actually saw one of these casinos in like the late 90s. And they're vast, just big giant casinos with a huge ramp that leads from the beach, the parking lot, up into the casino. And so the tribe wanted to have one of those casinos. And their business partners promised them that they would have one. So they started sending money to the casino developers in 2004 and early 2005. And if you remember anything about the Gulf Coast in 2005, you will know the words Hurricane Katrina. All of those casinos were absolutely destroyed. It was the stupidest fucking idea ever to build a casino in a hurricane alley. So notwithstanding all the horror show that was Katrina, the tribe's business ventures completely collapsed. There was never going to be another casino built. Maybe there is now, but there was not going to be for a long time a casino built on the Gulf Coast like that. It's just stupid. The very idea of it is ridiculous. Anyway, so the tribe stopped paying. And actually the bank and everybody came back to the tribe and said, we're going to sue you for breach of contract. We still want our money unless you cut a new deal with us. And, you know, the tribal government, a few years later, was still as desperate for revenue. It probably made a bunch of promises to their constituents and, you know, the people who vote for them. So they did a deal. On Thursday or Friday, the banks, the lenders, the developers, the investors, and their attorneys all descended on the tribe. They worked over the weekend, and on Monday, they cut the deal. They signed all the agreements. And I'm here to tell you, if you're going to do a big financing like that with a huge trust indenture and 11 separate contracts between probably six or seven different banks and lenders and trustees, you need more than 3 fucking days to do it. And this thing reads like the clusterfuck that it is. It is a whole bunch of incompetent garbage. And it was there's no doubt in my mind. It was imposed coercively by these outsiders on a tribal government with a bunch of people who were desperate for re-election and desperate for cash because of promises they had made. And they were more than willing to throw good money after bad into a money pit that is the Mississippi gambling industry. And it's wildly unfortunate. So a couple of years after the tribe started continuing to pay this into this black hole of nothing, they started going bankrupt. The economy tanked in 2008. I'm sure you remember that. So the tribe literally had to shut, I keep saying that fucking word. The tribe stopped operating in the summer, wintertime. It had to stop operating about 2/3 of its tribal government services. They shut down almost everything at the tribe because every single dollar from their casino was going to these outside investors. And after a winter of that, they just stopped paying and said, come, just sue us. Just get it over with. But they had a defense. They had a secret defense, which is not secret. The defense is, when you enter into an agreement with an Indian tribe to do an off-reservation gaming facility or any kind of gaming facility, under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, you're a gaming management company. And that's what these investors were, gaming management companies. And every contract between a gaming management company and an Indian tribe under IGRA, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, must be approved by the chairman of the National Indian Gaming Commission, or it is void ab initio. So the tribe, when it was sued by the investors, which included Saybrook, which is the lead defendant in the case that I worked on, this is years later, by the way. When the tribe was sued, it got Kevin Washburn, who's now the dean of Iowa and former general counsel for NIGC, to write a very superficial opinion saying, obviously, this is a gaming management contract. It was never approved by NIGC, is therefore void, and the tribe is free to stop payment under that arrangement. And so it did. And it won. Seventh Circuit agreed with the tribe, which, yay tribe. And that meant also, by the way, incidentally, I even celebrated and I thought, hey, good for this tribe. I mean, they're good guys and they're stupid, but they were able to avoid something really horrible. For the next 2 years, no tribe was able to get financing for casino operations because of this case, because nobody trusted tribes anymore. So that's a bit of an stupid response to the industry to this, but that's how big these cases can be. And this tribe has never been wealthy. So it did stop payment, but that only worked as to the trust indenture beneficiary, which is Wells Fargo Bank. Saybrook and the other investors had separate agreements with the tribe, and they still thought that they were going to get their money. And my portion of the case, the focus of it was involved Saybrook and that entity and those continuing contracts. So they brought suit against the tribe in state court in a county that is far from Lac du Flambeau, that's outside of Milwaukee. It is the most conservative Republican county in Wisconsin, has no connection whatsoever to any of the parties or the tribe, but it is a court in Wisconsin, and they're all courts of general jurisdiction. So the tribe had agreed that if you, that flurry of weekend agreements, that it would consent to waivers of sovereign immunity in state or federal courts. And this was a state court, so they consented to jurisdiction there. That judge, by the way, not a friend of basically anybody who has brown skin. He's just a big, giant piece of shit. So once the tribe was sued in state court, they were also sued in federal court, by the way. The tribe bought its own lawsuit in tribal court. I know an attorney who works out of Minneapolis. I've seen him casually, socially over the years. Reached out to me and said, hey, I work for this tribe and they're looking for a tribal judge. Would you be interested in handling this one case? He didn't tell me what it was. He was like, it's a complex commercial issue. And I was like, yeah, what the hell? I'll take it. Had no idea this was going to be it. Because I've been following the whole Wells Fargo thing for many years. And I wish I hadn't said yes, but I did. And here I was in this case. So there's four cases pending. There's one in tribal court, two in state court, two in federal court, two different federal districts. They went one in the eastern and one in the western, Wisconsin, and the one in that crazy county in Wisconsin. There's a rule in Wisconsin, which is a public law 280 state. If there are two cases involving tribes, that one is pending in state and one is pending in tribal court. The two judges are supposed to call each other and decide which is the proper court for the case to be heard. And the tribe thought that I would call this judge in the circuit court outside of Milwaukee to talk about who should have the case. And I read the rule and it didn't say that. The state court judge is supposed to call me, the tribal judge. And he never called, so I never had to talk to him. I knew he wasn't going to call as soon as I read the rule and found out who he was. So all of these cases are pending at all at the same time, going on parallel lives. I think one of the federal courts kicked its out because it was just stupid to have two federal districts in one state handling the same exact case. But so I got a motion to dismiss from Saybrook et al. And on the contract, most specifically involving the forum selection clause and the concomitant waivers of sovereign immunity. Remember, I told you there were 11 different contracts, and I can't remember exactly how many, but five or six of them had this forum selection clause in which basically said the tribe consents to be sued in federal or state court, and it waives its immunity in federal or state court. And the tribe agrees that it will not be sued in tribal court. So the tribe's argument basically was, we didn't agree to not suing in tribal court, you know, which is kind of a wishy-washy argument to make, to be frank. Well, it was a declaratory judgment that they didn't owe any money to anybody. Plus, they were bringing a claim against the attorneys who were incompetent, negligence claim, a fiduciary duty type claim against the law firm. And I totally agree with the incompetence thing. You do not negotiate a deal like this over a few days, over the weekend. Part of what I'm about to say next is exactly why. A forum selection clause, if you're in the right jurisdiction, is really easy to get out of. Most jurisdictions interpret a forum selection clause liberally to allow for you to choose a different forum. And it's whether or not you use passive voice in your forum selection clause. So in New York, for example, and in Wisconsin state courts, I had to look this up. if the forum selection clause says something along the lines of the parties agree that the forum for this case shall be this whatever jurisdiction you choose. That is a passive forum selection clause. It should say that the jurisdiction is the sole and exclusive forum by which you can vindicate your rights. The first, that is an active one. That is very exclusive forum selection clause. That is the right way to draft a forum selection clause. If you say that the state courts of Wisconsin or the federal courts of Wisconsin are the forum for a type of claim, that all that does is say, yes, it is. It doesn't say anything about any other court. So you can still bring a claim in another court, which defeats the purpose of the forum selection clause, to be sure. But just on the plain text of a forum selection clause, most, but not all jurisdictions would say it is not an exclusive forum selection clause. Now, all the parties told me to follow the laws of the state of Wisconsin. And Wisconsin had multiple appellate courts that followed the rule about active or exclusive versus passive, non-exclusive forum selection clauses, sort of the liberal rule, okay? And I asked the parties about this at oral argument, and you know the other side, the Saybrook side, the other side from the tribe, was really hemming and hawing. And the tribe, I don't even think, realized the argument it had made until I asked them that argument at the question at oral argument. I'm like, yeah. So if Wisconsin law, the courts of appeal of Wisconsin, there hadn't been a Wisconsin Supreme Court case, had adopted the liberal interpretation of forum selection clauses, that was the rule. And the tribe is like, yeah, they think they're going to win this. So they can actually avoid a motion to dismiss anyway in tribal court. And I did make it clear that that's all this was a motion to dismiss on the pleadings. Now, if we had gone to trial and got all the parties on the stand or even in depositions to get affidavits about what the meaning of the forum selection clauses were, I don't think the tribe would have won. And there's no doubt in my mind, no serious doubt in my mind that the tribe intended to agree to not go to tribal court. But that's not where we were. We were at the pleading stage. We were looking at Wisconsin law that liberally interpreted forum selection clauses. So I felt justified as a judge in denying the motion to dismiss. Now, here's what happened in the federal court is that the tribe made all those arguments to the federal court, and they rejected the tribe's arguments. And they said in the Seventh Circuit, which includes Wisconsin, you know the Seventh Circuit? You know enough about the Seventh Circuit to know it's full of people like Posner and Easterbrook. They're like these crazy right-wing law and economics people who interpret contracts only to the benefit of industry and not consumers. I mean, very conservative, business-oriented district, circuit. And they had actually had a case in the 80s about a forum selection clause involving a tribal housing authority that they construed in the narrow light, along with all their other time they construed forum selection clauses. So they applied their own law, not the law of Wisconsin. They ignored the law of Wisconsin. So I think they got that one wrong. But again, their procedural posture was different than the one that I had before me, which is a motion to dismiss on the pleadings. And I did not read terribly carefully the Seventh Circuit and the federal court proceedings, in part because there was the possibility for several years after this that it would come back to me somehow. The tribe actually won. They remember that crazy judge, the state court judge and circuit court, they lost there, but they won on appeal. They won some big, big issues from the Wisconsin Court of Appeals that are unrelated to the forum selection clause. So the tribe eventually did prevail ultimately in the case through settlement negotiations, as far as I understand, but it took several years after this. But it was weird for the Seventh Circuit to do what they did. And both the judge at the district court level and the panel of the Seventh Circuit quoted extensively from the briefings of Saybrook et al. That attacked me for being a pro-Indian tribal member who ran a blog, and I was like some sort of social media weirdo that isn't to be trusted. And of course the tribe would hire a wacko like me to be their judge. None of that's totally inaccurate, but the fact that I ran a blog as a judge is totally irrelevant to the merits of the case. But they put it, both courts put that, described me in that way in their opinions. All this goes to show that, you know, it matters who the tribal judges are, and which is unfortunate. It doesn't matter who state or federal judges are. I mean, it does, but they're never as explicitly called out or given so much shade as tribal judges are. And that's how you win cases if you're a non-member. Go after the judges. All right, I'm done. Any questions? All right. So, long day. We're done for now. Tomorrow, you know, we'll... It'd be a wishy-washy day. We won't go for very long. I don't really know what else to say. It'd be a wrap-up day, I guess you could say. I'll talk a little bit about Anishinaabe custom and tradition just to give you a sense that there's an alternate universe out there of real people that do things that are kind of interesting outside of federal and state courts. But other than that, it shouldn't take too long. Unless you have, and we'll have plenty of time to review and wrap up any questions you have. So, good. Thank you. See you tomorrow. Any questions? Go ahead. Well, since I haven't registered, I don't know where to go either. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I see that, too. That's weird. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I can tell you, let's see, I can give you the name. I would reach out to the woman who's the Indian law clinician at UCLA. Her name is Lauren. Indian law clinic. Just email her. They you know, part of it is their fault. They keep changing the they've sent me a couple of times updated flyers. So that may be part of it. But you're right, even the whole clinic is blocked. That's weird. So I don't know what to say. They just emailed me yesterday to say there's 140 people registered for it, so. Which seems like an awful lot of people. Oh, wait, maybe I got a Zoom link. I can just send that to you. Maybe I can. That's a good idea. Cool. Good deal. All right. Let's see. Got two chat questions. Oh, there it is. Yeah. Good call. Yeah. Well, like I said, my relatives are very, very Christian, very Protestant, very evangelical, and not all of them, but some of them. And I'm not sure what it is. In Southwest Michigan, the tribes were not recognized for many years. And so there was some boarding school stuff. And there was also some history of, it's going back as far as the 1830s, of agreeing to convert in exchange for not being removed by the military. So Pokagon Band Potawatomi, Leopold Pokagon in 1833, promised to let missionaries into his village in exchange for not being removed to Kansas and Iowa. And I think that it's a long time ago, but I think there's still an aspect of when that conversion happened a long time ago. So, the Anishinaabe religions, the Medewin Lodge, and those kinds of lodges never really took hold, sort of disappeared at that time. A lot of the tribes in the East and in the Midwest, not a lot, not a majority, but a lot of them organized in religious towns around a church and became very almost Puritan. Kind of like the Northeastern churches. They used to call them, I can't remember the phrase. Praying towns, that's right. They were praying towns in the Northeast. They didn't call them that in the Midwest, but I still think you see some of those. And I know with the Southwestern Potawatomi tribes, the ones that are my relatives, had a lot of the, they weren't formally called praying towns, but that's effectively what they were. The whole tribal community was organized around these missions, these churches. And so that explains a lot of the Protestantism, I think, and that continues to this day to be pretty robust. There's some people who want to go back to the old traditions and, maybe they didn't like what happened to them in boarding schools or they just don't like church. I'm one of those people who just don't like church, but... then you look in California Southwest, they're Catholics. I mean, they're very robust conservative Catholic, while merging a lot of their indigenous religious traditions into the Catholicism. So Pascua-Yaqui tribe, the first tribe I worked for, the word Pascua means Easter. They're the Easter Indians. So we got 2 weeks off for Easter at Pascua, and they do Easter, but they've merged it seamlessly with their... indigenous religion, and it's surreal to see. From my perspective as somebody who knows a lot about Easter and the Old Testament and the New Old and New Testament, how, what they did with it, it's really fascinating as an outsider to observe that. Very, very socially conservative, though, at the same time. A lot of that same conservative evangelical type thinking is present in a lot of that. But there are always people pushing back on that stuff. Heathens like me, I guess. I don't know. It's just like any religious thing. It's individual, and tribes are all different. Even the ones that are that grew up right next to each other, you know, they have similar histories. They do different things, right? So those impacts are, you know, intergenerational, and they stay ingrained for a long time in some places. Sure. Any other questions? All right, we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you very much.